From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
Well, he was terrified all the time. And when I would ask him about the interrogation, it was as though he was monitoring what he was saying, as though he would pay for this later, as though his interrogators would know about it.
Today, a Democracy Now! National exclusive, forensic psychiatrist Dr. Angela Hegarty. She spent over 22 hours interviewing Jose Padilla to determine the state of his mental health. Padilla is the U.S. citizen who was classified by President Bush as an enemy combatant and held in extreme isolation for over 3.5 years. His case is now before a Florida jury. Then, a look at the new documentary, The 11th Hour.
During this critical period of human history, healing the damage of industrial civilization is the task of our generation. Our response depends on the conscious evolution of our species, and this response could very well save this unique blue planet for future generations.
Actor Leonardo DiCaprio narrates the new film that includes Nobel Peace Laureate Wangari Maathai, physicist Stephen Hawking, and former Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev. We'll speak with the filmmakers in Los Angeles. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. At least 500 people are now feared dead from Tuesday's massive suicide bombing in northern Iraq. The initial toll of 250 had already made it the deadliest attack of the Iraq War. Rescue workers continue to pull bodies from the rubble of more than 30 destroyed buildings, including several homes. The bombings targeted a Kurdish area home to followers of the Yazidi religion. Three suicide trucks carrying 2 tons of explosives attacked almost simultaneously. In Peru, at least 300 people have been killed and 200 injured in an earthquake off Peru's central coast. The worst damage came in the southwestern cities of Ica and Pisco. Iran is brushing off the Bush administration's vow to label the Iranian Revolutionary Guards a terrorist group. A Revolutionary Guard spokesperson said the Iranian force will continue to grow in size and prepare to retaliate in the event of a U.S. strike. The Washington Post reports European and Arab allies are expressing alarm at the administration's new policy. Critics inside Iran have long claimed unilateral U.S. actions are strengthening the Iranian government's control while isolating pro-democracy activists. But State Department spokesperson Sean McCormick said the move is justified.
They now have tentacles into all sorts of different activities, into business activities, into banking activities. We all know about their support for those groups that are going after our troops in Iraq. We also have talked about their supplying arms to the Taliban in Afghanistan. And there have also been numerous news reports about their linkages with Hezbollah and other terrorist organizations.
One of the world's largest international charities has announced it'll stop accepting millions of dollars in U.S. food aid over concerns American methods are doing more harm than good. CARE International says aid efforts are hampered by U.S. requirements on monetized food aid. Instead of directly going to needy communities, U.S. grains are shipped on condition charities sell them on the local market and then use the proceeds for their activities. CARE says the program is inefficient and results in food shipments to those who can afford them, not those in need. The U.S. program has also been faulted for shuttering local producers unable to compete with subsidized American prices. Several CARE officials involved in the American program have criticized the practice. CARE employee George Odo said, quote, "If someone wants to help you, they shouldn't do it by destroying the very thing they're trying to promote." Newly released documents show the Pakistani government gave pivotal military support to the Taliban in the years leading up to the 9/11 attacks. According to the National Security Archive, Pakistan sent arms and soldiers into Afghanistan to fight alongside the Taliban. In other Pakistan news, the New York Times reports the Bush administration is pressuring General Pervez Musharraf to share power with his main rival. The administration is reportedly concerned popular pressure will force Musharraf to step down. White House officials are said to have asked Musharraf to share power with former Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto. In Sudan, UN officials say the Sudanese government has agreed to let an ailing Darfur rebel chief travel to Kenya for medical treatment. Suleiman Jamus was the humanitarian coordinator for the Sudan Liberation Army when he was arrested more than a year ago. He's been confined to a UN base since. In other Darfur news, African Union countries have begun pledging troop numbers towards a joint peacekeeping force with the UN. This is African Union UN Joint Representative Rodolphe Adada.
African countries are ready to contribute in troops, and the pledges are very high, but we have to, they have to meet the standard of the United Nations. So at the moment, we cannot say exactly how long it will take. Anyway, the troop-contributing countries have to make their pledge till the 30th of this month.
A U.S. district court judge has rejected oil giant Chevron's final attempt to avoid trial for its alleged role in attacks on villagers in Nigeria. Nine Nigerian plaintiffs accuse Chevron of recruiting and supplying Nigerian military forces involved in shooting and killing protesters. Chevron is also accused of complicity in an attack on two villages that killed four people. On Tuesday, Judge Susan Ilston said the case should proceed based on evidence showing direct links to Chevron officials. An online travel firm has become the first of its kind to be fined for breaking the U.S. embargo on Cuba. Travelocity.com has paid more than $180,000 in penalties for booking trips between Cuba and the United States. The Bush administration has approved measures that will greatly expand the spying capabilities of domestic law enforcement and other agencies. A new program will allow state and local officials to view data from satellite and aircraft sensors that can penetrate cloud cover, buildings, and underground facilities. Most of the surveillance technology has previously been limited to foreign surveillance. Civil liberties groups are raising concerns. Kate Martin of the Center for National Security Studies called the program, quote, Big Brother in the sky. She added, quote, they are laying the bricks one at a time for a police state. In military news, a new Pentagon report shows Army suicides are at their highest rate in 26 years. At least 99 service members took their own lives last year. More than a quarter did so while serving in Iraq and Afghanistan. A grand jury has decided not to indict a soldier who admitted to paying a friend to shoot him in the leg so he could avoid redeploying to Iraq. Private Jonathan Aponte paid $500 to be shot the day he was scheduled to report to duty. Although Aponte avoids charges, both his wife and the gunman have been indicted for their roles. Newly released documents show Donald Rumsfeld stepped down as defense secretary earlier than publicly disclosed. Rumsfeld's departure was announced one day after the Democratic victory in last November's midterm elections, but his resignation was actually submitted one day before voters went to the polls. The delay reportedly angered some Republican lawmakers who believe their electoral chances could have improved had voters known Rumsfeld had stepped down. In Washington, D.C., city officials have threatened a $10,000 fine to the anti-war group Answer unless it removes posters promoting an upcoming peace march. Several hundred yellow posters have been posted around the city announcing the September 15th event. The protest is timed to coincide with the release of a Pentagon report on the so-called troop surge in Iraq. D.C. officials say the posters are illegal because they don't meet city standards on adhesive use. Answer calls the fine threat a political move aimed at silencing the march. And the CIA has turned up on a list of groups that have edited entries on the popular online encyclopedia Wikipedia. According to Wikipedia Scanner, a user logging on from the CIA's web domain made edits to the entry for the Iranian president, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. The controversial voting machine company Diebold has also been caught making changes. In 2005, a Diebold computer was used to remove paragraphs describing Chief Executive Walden O'Dell as a top fundraiser for President Bush. Paragraphs and links referring to voter fraud in the 2000 elections were also taken down. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And welcome to all of our listeners and viewers around the country and around the world. A jury began deliberations on Wednesday in Miami in the case of Jose Padilla, the Brooklyn-born man accused by the Bush administration of plotting to set off a dirty bomb inside the United States. The FBI initially arrested him secretly in Chicago in 2002 after he got off a plane from Europe. For a month, he was held as a material witness. Then Attorney General John Ashcroft made a dramatic announcement. The U.S. government had disrupted an al-Qaeda plot to set off nuclear dirty bombs inside the United States. At the center of the plot, Ashcroft alleged, was Padilla.
President Bush then classified Jose Padilla as an enemy combatant, stripping him of all his rights. He was transferred to a Navy brig in South Carolina, where he was held in extreme isolation for 43 months. The Christian Science Monitor reported Padilla's cell measured 9 feet by 7 feet. The windows were covered over. He had no pillow, no sheet, no clock, no calendar, no radio, no television, no telephone calls, no visitors. Even Padilla's lawyer was prevented from seeing him for nearly 2 years.
According to his attorneys, Padilla was routinely tortured in ways designed to cause pain, anguish, depression, and ultimately the loss of will to live. His lawyers have claimed that Padilla was forced to take LSD and PCP to act as a sort of truth serums during his interrogations. Up until last year, the Bush administration maintained that it had the legal right to hold Padilla without charge forever. But when faced with a Supreme Court challenge, President Bush transferred Padilla out of military custody to face criminal charges.
On January 3, 2006, the government charged him and two others with criminal conspiracy. The government claims Padilla, along with his mentor, Adham Amin Hassoun, and Hassoun's colleague, Kifawa El-Jayusi, conspired to commit murder abroad and to provide material support toward that goal. Since May, the men have been on trial in Miami. According to the Miami Herald, the overall case against Padilla is riddled with circumstantial evidence. Much of the case is built around an alleged form Padilla filled out to attend an al-Qaeda training camp. Prosecutors have not introduced no evidence of personal involvement by Padilla in planning or carrying out any violent acts. There's no mention of Padilla plotting to set off a dirty bomb. Despite this, prosecutors are seeking a life sentence for Padilla.
Questions have also been raised about whether Padilla was mentally fit to stand trial. His lawyers and family say he's become clearly mentally ill after being held in isolation for so long. Today, we're joined by one of the few medical experts who has spent time with Padilla since his arrest 5 years ago. Forensic psychiatrist Dr. Angela Hegarty spent 22 hours interviewing Padilla last year to determine the state of his mental health. She concluded that he lacked the capacity to assist in his own defense. Dr. Angela Hegarty is assistant professor of clinical psychiatry at Columbia University. She joins us today at our Firehouse studio. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
And thank you for joining us for this first national interview, broadcast interview that you are doing. How did you get involved in Jose Padilla's case?
Well, his attorneys called me up. For many years, I've had an interest in working with religious fundamentalists of all stripes, actually. And over the years, I had worked with lawyers in Miami as well as elsewhere in the country, and I guess they heard about me that way, and they called me up because, essentially, he wasn't really talking to them, and it was clear to them that something was very wrong, but they didn't know quite what it was at this point. And the initial goal was for me to come down and see if I could help build a rapport with him, help him really begin to act, you know, with his lawyers to advocate for himself, to help them defend his case. He wasn't doing that, and so I came down and to spend some time with him.
And what did you find? Where did you first meet Jose Padilla?
Well, I first met Mr. Padilla in the Miami Detention Center, where he's held under special conditions. In a conference room with a double mirror, and we spent 22 hours in that room together.
And how did he react to you initially? Because obviously, after being in isolation and then with he has had not had a good relationship with his lawyers, as I understand, for quite a while. But how did he react to you?
Well, he really didn't want to talk to a psychiatrist at all. He didn't want to be evaluated at all. He was incredibly anxious. I remember the first day, after about the first hour, he smiled for a moment and said, you know, this really isn't as bad as he thought it would be. He would obviously had was very, very anxious. And in the course of the interview, he revealed to me that he essentially had been told that if he relayed any of what had happened to him, his experiences, people would, quote unquote, know he was crazy. And he was very upset by this and very disturbed by it. And it's just his level of being so disturbed suggested to me that there was something more, but, you know, asking further questions, he wouldn't reveal it to me. He was resentful of his lawyers. He had left the brig thinking he was about to be released. He told me that he'd been given regular clothing and was actually surprised to find himself incarcerated. He was very angry at his lawyers that they hadn't gotten him out, and that, in fact, his conditions in the Miami Detention Center under the special conditions in which he was held were actually somewhat more restrictive and more isolating than they had been in the later stages of his detention at the brig. So he was angry with them. He also felt that everything had been established, everything, you know, that the government knew everything, and that essentially they would, there was no need for him to be revealing things to his lawyers, and he was very uncomfortable.
What was the effect of over 3.5 years of isolation on Jose Padilla?
I think there's two things, really. Number one, his family more than anything, and his friends, who had had a chance to see him by the time I spoke with them, said he was changed. There was something wrong. There was something very weird was the word one of his siblings used. Something weird about him. There was something not right. He was a different man. And the second thing was his absolute state of terror, alternating with numbness, largely. It was as though the interrogators were in the room with us. He was like, perhaps like a trauma victim who knew that they were going to be sent back to the person who hurt them, and that he would, as I said earlier, he would subsequently pay a price if he revealed what happened. So I think those would be the two main things. Also, he had developed, actually a third thing, he had developed really a tremendous identification with the goals and interests of the government. I really considered a diagnosis of Stockholm Syndrome. For example, at one point in the proceedings, his attorneys had, you know, done well cross-examining an FBI agent. And instead of feeling happy about it, like all the other defendants I've seen over the years, he was actually very angry with them. He was very angry that the civil proceedings were unfair to the commander-in-chief, quote-unquote. And in fact, there's one thing that happened that disturbed me particularly was when he saw his mother, he wanted her to contact President Bush to help him, help him out of his dilemma. He expected that the government might help him if he was good, quote-unquote.
In the affidavit you submitted to the court, summarizing your examination of him, you also talk about the things he did say that happened to him, the sleeping on a steel bed with no mattress for all that time that he was isolated?
Yes. In the darkness, or in the light, in the cells, the light would be all dark for a long time or all light for a long time, and for a very long part of his detention, he had no mattress at all, and sometimes he would try to sleep on the pallet, if you will, the hard steel pallet. Or other times he would be in essentially stress positions where he's got shackles and a belt and is in an awkward and uncomfortable position for very long periods at a time.
What other things did he say, tell you, were done to him?
Well, I think one of the things you have to realize is he was adamant that he would not reveal any, quote-unquote, classified information. He, in fact, refused to provide a narrative of his account. He essentially, on the second day after spending 4 hours on the Monday, and we developed some rapport, on the second day I brought him in a list of materials interrogation tactics that had been already, you know, were in the public record. And I asked him just merely to say yes or no to some of these things. And this included slapping, exposure to heat or cold for long periods of time, forcible showering. He was terrified, actually, about being taken to a thing called the cage. This was supposedly recreation. I would like to put that in quotes. He spoke about the lack of sleep, the relentless clicking and then banging of the doors of other cells that would wake him up.
Explain that. Wasn't he alone in the naval brig?
Yes, he was. In this very small cell, he was monitored 24 hours a day, and the doors were managed electronically. And between what Mr. Padilla told us and other sources, essentially it's possible to open and close these doors electronically. And he would hear the click of the door opening, which is a loud click that sort of echoed, and then a very loud bang over and over and over again for hours at a time, possibly days. He had no way of knowing the time. The light was always artificial. The windows were blackened. He had no calendar or time, as you mentioned earlier. He really didn't see people, especially in the beginning. He only had contact with his interrogators.
Did he recognize you when you returned the next day?
Oh, yes. Yes, he did. But he did have some memory problems in that by about the fourth day, I asked him, can you just give me... He'd been very clear that there was a particularly bad time, and then there was a somewhat better time, and then after he had access to counsel, things improved somewhat. And he really was unable to give me any kind of... beyond the most broadest brushstrokes, he was unable to put anything in a kind of a chronological narrative at all. He was very, what we would call in psychiatry, concrete. You would ask him, how did you feel about something or what have you? And he would generally resort to cliches. He seemed to have a great deal of difficulty recalling precise personal details about the interrogations or the experiences. Or particular incidents. He wouldn't know when they happened or how long they lasted and so forth.
Did you conclude he'd been tortured?
Well, torture, of course, is a legal term. However, as a clinician, I've worked with torture victims and, of course, abuse victims for a few decades now, actually. I think from a clinical point of view, he was tortured.
We're going to break, and then we're going to come back. We're talking to Dr. Angela Hegarty, a forensic psychiatrist, spent 22 years interviewing Jose Padilla last year, 22 hours interviewing Jose Padilla last year, assistant professor of clinical psychiatry at Columbia University. This is the first time she is speaking out in national broadcast about her assessment of Jose Padilla. His case is now before a jury in Florida. Stay with us.
We'll get rid of the dictator, rebuild your country, make sure all your kids go to school. We'll clean up the cities, get the sewage plants running, institute parliamentary rule. We'll bring you autonomy, senators and judges, and a shiny new blue banner. We'll bring you pride and prosperity, food in your bellies, in every home a phone, fax, and scanner. After we torture our prisoners, we'll bring you decades of peace, spiritual release, free religious expression. You can say what you want in the papers you run. We'll never force a confession. After we torture our prisoners, the oil will flow just where it should go, across the desert and into the sea. You'll thank your God and the CIA that finally you are free.
And that is David Rovics, After We Torture Our Prisoners. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting in over 500 stations around the country. On Pacifica and NPR and low-power FM and college and community radio stations, on public access TV and PBS TV stations and both TV satellite networks, on Dish Network Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and on DirecTV Channel 375. And we're video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org. Our headlines are also available in Spanish in audio and transcript form. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Our guest is Dr. Angela Hegarty, forensic psychiatrist, who spent more than 22 hours interviewing Jose Padilla last year. She's an assistant professor of clinical psychiatry at Columbia University. Jose Padilla's case is before a Florida jury right now. Juan?
Yeah, I'd like to ask you about some of the assessments by folks other than you in his case. I understand it was a Bureau of Prisons medical person who interviewed him and also concluded that he had mental problems, but that they really were not severe. And I think the judge as well in the case at one point acknowledged that he had some mental problems, but that said that they should not be considered at the causes of them as part of the process of the trial. Your sense of some of these other assessments?
Certainly. Well, first of all, there's a big distinction between the diagnosis of a psychiatric or mental illness on the one hand and finding of legal incapacity to proceed with trial. That's a legal term, and there are legal standards based on case law. And, of course, the judge relied on the legal standards and concluded that the defense had not met its burden in proving that he lacked capacity. Now, of course, each interview that different people have is incredibly sensitive to a number of factors: the context, who the person is, their style, their interviewing techniques, their experience, and also, most importantly, who they are to the interviewee or the defendant in this case. And, of course, from reading Dr. Buigas's report, it's clear that
He's from the Bureau of Prisons.
That's right. It was clear that he saw a different side of the defendant. Perhaps the defendant Mr. Padilla reacted somewhat differently to him. He was a government doctor. Dr. Buigas actually interviewed him in his own office, whereas defense experts had to use this conference room with the double mirror. So the whole interview occurred in a very different context. And that's why we have adversarial hearings, where one group of experts will go and put their case, and then the other group of experts, and then the finder of fact, or the judge in this case, decides. But yes, he agreed that he did have some psychiatric or psychological problems, but that they weren't as severe as those the defense had seen. Part of the problem, though, with that, and I want to add this, is that Mr. Padilla was really very reluctant to cooperate. In fact, he refused to finish the psychological testing that I was administering, and also what Dr. Zaff administered, because essentially he wasn't exactly the easiest person to elicit the kind of clinical information we need.
What about the findings that he was, well, the equivalent after his experience of 3.5 years in severe isolation and the what happened to him during that period of brain damaged?
Well, during my time with him, some of his reasoning seemed somewhat impaired. Some of his thinking seemed impaired. His memory, certainly, his ability to pay attention seemed very impaired. I developed a differential diagnosis from this. Severe anxiety, post-traumatic stress disorder, can do that. But also, we know from really basic neuroscience studies that extreme isolation for prolonged periods of time, and I'm talking, you know, the studies are on maybe days or weeks, and he had extreme isolation for years, really do, in fact, impair hard brain function. And I recommended that we get some neuropsychological testing. And unfortunately, he wasn't able to fully cooperate with that. However, the testing we did was consistent with brain damage, yes.
Brain damage.
Yes.
And have you dealt with someone who had been in isolation for such a long period of time before?
No. This was the first time I ever met anybody who had been isolated for such an extraordinarily long period of time. I mean, the sensory deprivation studies, for example, tell us that without sleep especially, people will develop psychotic symptoms, hallucinations, panic attacks, depression, suicidality within days. And here we had a man who had been in this situation, utterly dependent on his interrogators, who didn't treat him all that nicely, for years. And apart from the only people I ever met who had such a protracted experience were people who were in detention camps overseas that would come close. But even then, they weren't subjected to the sensory deprivation. So, yes, he was somewhat of a unique case in that regard.
I think at one point in your affidavit, you talk about how he said that he felt at one point that a huge weight was crushing down on his chest. Did
yes.
he explain that?
Well, he thought he was having a heart attack, and he's a young, healthy man. Now, one possibility is, yes, he was having a heart attack, certainly with the kind of adrenaline that would be surging through his body, whether from what we call internal stimuli, hallucinations, panic, paranoia, and so forth, or as a result of what else was going on. It's not unreasonable. However, more likely, he also felt his life, he was slipping away, he was going to die. And this actually is almost a textbook description of a major panic attack, which, if anybody's had one, the word panic doesn't quite capture how terrible it is. You really feel like you're dying. And so his perceptions of what was happening to him and himself, which is one of the most terrifying aspects, was really difficult to assess. For example, he reported very clearly that he'd been given mind-altering drugs. And again, that is realistically, unfortunately, one serious hypothesis. However, another serious hypothesis...
What do you mean? Given by who?
By the government.
Drugged,
yes. And clearly he had some terrible, frightening experience that to which he attributed these drugs. However, again, given what sensory deprivation and isolation of the scale does, it's also entirely possible that he wasn't given drugs and it's just the psychiatric effects of the isolation and the sensory deprivation, that because the hallucinations can be incredibly vivid, people feel like they're losing their minds, that they're coming apart. It's absolutely terrifying.
We're interviewing Dr. Angela Hegarty, who is a forensic psychiatrist who saw Jose Padilla for more than 22 hours. The new Army Field Manual bars the use of isolation to achieve psychological disorientation through sensory deprivation. The manual states, sensory deprivation may result in extreme anxiety, hallucinations, as well as bizarre thoughts, depression, antisocial behavior. Detainees will not be subject to sensory deprivation. But you say he was.
Without question.
How afraid was Jose Padilla?
How to capture that in an apt metaphor? He was terrified. For him, the government was all powerful. The government knew everything. The government knew everything that he was doing. His interrogators would find out every little detail that he revealed, and he would be punished for it. He was convinced that, I mean, I think in words he endorsed, even if he won his case, he lost, because he was going back to the brig if he managed to prevail at trial. And essentially, if hypothetically one were to offer him a really long prison sentence versus, you know, with the guarantee that he wouldn't go back to the brig, versus risking going back to the brig, the chance that he might go back to the brig, he would take the prison sentence for a very long period of time. I think he would take almost anything rather than go back to that brig.
What happened in the brig?
What happened at the brig was essentially the destruction of a human being's mind. That's what happened at the brig. His personality was deconstructed and reformed. And essentially, like many abuse victims, whether it's torture survivors or battered women or even children who are abused by parents, as long as the parents or the abuser is in control in their minds, essentially they identify with the primary aims of the abuser. And all abusers, whoever they are, have one absolute requirement, and that is that you keep their secret. I mean, it's common knowledge that people who abuse children or women will say, look at what you made me do, putting the blame on the victim, trying to instill guilt. People will judge you. People will think you're crazy if you tell them about this. You will be an enemy. You will be seen as an enemy. You will be seen as a bad person if this comes out. There will be dire and terrible consequences, not only for you. Jose was very, very concerned that if torture allegations were made on his behalf, that somehow it would interfere with the government's ability to detain people at Guantanamo. And this was something he couldn't sign on to. He was very identified with the goals of the government.
Did he talk at all with you about his family and his concerns about what might happen to his family?
Yes. Essentially, when Mr. Padilla would talk about emotionally meaningful events or feelings, it would always be almost by accident. And he worried that his mother her life would be somehow derailed by this. He told people that his family had been threatened. His family was terrified. So again, always the tip of the iceberg with Mr. Padilla. He was very afraid for his family.
Can you talk about the Jacoby statement declaration and why the Bush administration did not want him to see attorneys?
Well, there was a quote in the Jacoby declaration that caught my attention as a forensic psychiatrist. And that essentially it says that the purpose of keeping Mr. Padilla isolated was to foster a sense of dependence on his interrogators and to essentially foreclose in his mind utterly any hope of rescue. And it makes reference to the fact that, given that people who've had contact with the criminal justice system will expect to see an attorney and be rescued by an attorney, they want to essentially disabuse him of the notion that he will ever be rescued. They want him to believe that he is in their power forever. And I believe, in a sense, they succeeded.
What does all of this do to our notions or expectation of how the criminal justice system is supposed to operate in this country?
Well, essentially, based on the Jacoby memorandum, it's, you know, it's a cultural cliche. You know, you have the right to remain silent. Anything you say can and will be used against you. You have the right to an attorney. Essentially, this, what happened to Mr. Padilla, was designed to reassure him that this was not, in fact, the case. The things we take for granted as American citizens, that we will not be get off a plane and be spirited away for years at the hands of harsh interrogators, that can happen in America. And as a citizen myself, I find it very disturbing, especially in the light of the mistakes that have been made over the years. I recall a case of an attorney who was misidentified from the West Coast, and he'd had a very tough experience as a result. And so the possibility that this could happen to an innocent person, a person perhaps who is merely known to somebody who themselves perhaps are being tortured, you know, their name might come up in such a circumstance, could actually be spirited away and entirely deprived of their human rights, their rights as human beings, their ordinary dignity, is disturbing.
Dr. Angela Hegarty, we are headed to San Francisco today. Today, tomorrow, Saturday, Sunday, Monday is the annual meeting of the American Psychological Association. You're a psychiatrist, but that's the group of 150,000 psychologists, and they are having a showdown right now. A vote will happen on Sunday, whether the APA will take a position against the involvement of its members, of psychologists, in coercive interrogations, in what many psychologists are saying, torture. There's a massive protest taking place tomorrow at 4 outside the Moscone Center. There'll be a track of debates inside the conference. Unfortunately, we wanted to record these debates, and the APA is now saying that there will be no video recording of discussions between the psychologists, public discussions where military psychologists debate others around the issue of whether psychologists should be involved in these interrogations. What are your thoughts, and what position has your organization, the American Psychiatric Association, taken?
Well, the American Psychiatric Association principles of ethics essentially follow the AMA's, which is we are
American
not,
Medical
American
Association.
Medical Association. Yes, is no psychiatrist is involved in torture ever under any circumstances. Period. There is no caveat that opens up the possibility by mentioning the Bush administration's qualifications on the definition of torture. That the psychologists are protesting and debating this is great news. Clinicians, our entire professional identity is clinicians, and if psychologists certainly see themselves as clinicians, people who care for people. Our entire professional identity as people who help people is obviated by such involvement. And I entirely disagree with any caveat that would allow a clinician to be involved in torture at any time.
What about the argument that those who don't want the moratorium are making, and especially high-level staff of the American Psychological Association, that for psychologists to be there is to bring ethics to the situation, to explain what is going too far?
Well, you know, I asked Mr. Padilla about that. He'd said that there were some decent people that he'd come in contact with, you know, especially in the latter part of his stay at the brig. And I asked him, I said, you know, if I were in a situation like this as a clinician, and I abhor what's being done to you, would you want me to stay, knowing that there's somebody who cares about you, who's ideally, hopefully, ethical? Or would you, albeit powerless, or would you want me to leave? And he actually gave me one of the first and only immediate and straightforward and direct answers. He would want me to leave. He would not want me there because for him, my presence endorses what's going on, even though, as I said, in my scenario, I would be powerless to do anything to change it.
And did he talk about having interactions with medical people, either doctors, psychiatrists, or psychologists, while in custody?
No. He just mentioned staff in general. He had some interactions with some kind of clinical staff around medication and evaluations, but it's unclear to me what their credentials were.
So you don't know if psychiatrists or psychologists were involved?
Oh, I know that some mental health professionals were involved, but by the way, this was designed. The sensory deprivation, especially the leaving and taking of stimuli from his environment. For example, there was a mirror that was there, and then that would be taken away abruptly, or he'd have a pillow or a sheet or something that made him a little more comfortable, and that would be taken away. One of the things that came out in the course of my evaluation was he was required to sign his name John Doe. This kind of thing, and the whole notion of dependency and the cultivation of dependency, the impact of sleep deprivation, stress positions, all of that was so coordinated. It's impossible for me to imagine that at least at some phase there wasn't some mental health professionals involved.
And what was the reason for wanting to have him sign his name John Doe?
He's no longer a person. He's no longer an individual. There will be no record that he was ever there. That the interrogators, and this is from my knowledge of torture around the world, that the interrogators essentially will be absolutely immune to any accountability.
After having met with him for 22 hours, as we wrap up, Dr. Hegarty, your conclusions about his case, Jose Padilla's case, as it stands now before a jury in a Florida court?
You know, I don't know if he's guilty or not of the charges that they brought against him. But He has certainly paid already, before he was ever found guilty, he's already paid a tremendous price for his trip to the Middle East.
I want to thank you for being with us, Dr. Angela Hegarty, forensic psychiatrist, assistant professor of clinical psychiatry at Columbia University, one of the forensic psychiatrists who met Jose Padilla, one of the very few speaking out now for the first time, 22 hours she interviewed him. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. When we come back, we'll go to Los Angeles to speak with the filmmakers who made The 11th Hour. Stay with us.
Before the oceans rise with the melting ice, before the strong winds tear through the warming air, before another species signs up before its time, we can still reverse it. We can still reverse it. Or make it worse, cause they got flood, and there'll be rains, and there'll be droughts.
Yes, that's the Gallerists. Step it up. Here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report, I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
The 11th Hour is a new feature-length documentary on the extent and gravity of the global environmental crisis and its impact on human life as we know it. It describes this present moment as the very last when change is possible and features suggestions for restorative action from prominent figures around the world. The film is produced and narrated by actor Leonardo DiCaprio and includes interviews with Nobel Peace Laureate Wangari Maathai, physicist Stephen Hawking, former Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev, and environmentalist Bill McKibben.
The 11th Hour opens Friday in New York, in Los Angeles. Nadja Connors and Leila Connors-Peterson co-directed and co-wrote the film. They join us from Los Angeles. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Let's begin
Thank you.
It's great to have you with us. Why did you do this film, Nadja Connors?
Well, we were looking at the debate out in mainstream media, and we were seeing a lack of response to what was actually happening in reality. And with the troubles increasing in the environment, we felt that what we wanted to do was make a film that encapsulated everything that was going on, plus the solutions at the same time. And we were hoping that we could sort of bring to the forefront that which mainstream media was sort of failing to deal with.
I wanted to go to the first clip, and it's the narrator of your film, Leonardo DiCaprio. This is what he has to say in The 11th Hour.
During this critical period of human history, healing the damage of industrial civilization is the task of our generation. Our response depends on the conscious evolution of our species. And this response could very well save this unique blue planet for future generations.
Leonardo DiCaprio, can you talk about why Layla Connors Peterson, and by the way, Nadja and Layla are sisters, why you chose Leonardo DiCaprio to narrate this film and his involvement in it?
Sure. We actually co-created this project with Leonardo. So Leonardo, we didn't choose him so much as we created it with him from the beginning. And we basically all three felt, as Nadja said previous, that the debate in this country wasn't where it should be when all ecosystems are in decline and those ecosystems support our form of life. And working with someone like Leonardo, we were hoping, and Leo himself said, you know, he hoped that his work, his, you know, work in film and his name recognition would help cut through some of the white noise in the media debate around these issues, because for whatever reason, you know, the Earth is our only home, and we're gambling with the Earth's life support systems and the behaviors that we have in our industrial civilized world. So if that's the case, why aren't the stories being told, and why aren't they front page news every day? And so that is why, working with him, we hope that the message would come through.
And I'd like to ask Nadja, the Al Gore film, obviously, Inconvenient Truth, has begun to shift dramatically, at least some public consciousness about our environment. How do you see your film, obviously, as continuing to move in that path, or do you take a different tack from his film?
Well, certainly an Inconvenient Truth put global warming on the map in a major way. But I think that, again, the response, whether it's from people on a societal level or whether it's from governments and corporations, the knowledge is out there, but the response hasn't met the scale of the problem. And I think what we're thinking about and what we're looking towards is we need to get to what is like the next civil rights movement in the United States. It has to be a broad movement. Literally, people have to hit the streets on all levels to turn this around. And so, you know, in our loftiest goals, this film could help potentially tip that balance in that direction to get people together to start talking to each other in community, because right now there's this very isolated sense of people understanding bits and pieces of the problem and then saying, well, what are the 10 things that I can do? And while those things are important, that's not what we need to really be doing, is getting together in communities and reclaiming our citizenship and really finding a way back to. So in essence, I think that our hope is that our film can build on what the knowledge of an Inconvenient Truth did, but really inspire you at a core level to have a consciousness shift that will make you really want to get out there and change things.
Let's turn to a clip of Nobel Prize winner Wangari Maathai, the founder of the Green Belt Movement in Kenya.
One part of the world, I keep telling people, let us not cut trees irresponsibly. Let us not destroy, especially the forested mountains. Because if you destroy the forests on these mountains, the rivers will stop flowing, and the rains will become irregular, and the crops will fail, and you will die of hunger and starvation. Now, the problem is people don't make those linkages.
That was Wangari Maathai. Orin Lyons is also featured in the film The Faith Keeper from the Turtle Clan of Onondaga Nation. This is a clip of Mr. Lyons from The 11th Hour.
So that if we choose to eradicate ourselves from this earth, by whatever means, the earth goes nowhere. And in time, it will regenerate, and all the lakes will be pristine. The rivers, the waters, the mountains, everything will be green again. It'll be peaceful. There may not be people, but the earth will regenerate. And you know why? Because the earth has all the time in the world, and we don't. So I think that's where we're at right now.
Also in the film, interestingly, is former CIA director James Woolsey, a man not exactly known in the past for environmental concern, but as one of the chief advocates in the lead-up to the invasion of Iraq. This is a clip of James Woolsey from 11th Hour.
Winston Churchill had it right about us. He said, the Americans always do the right thing, but unfortunately, it's only after they've exhausted all other possibilities. And we've been exhausting some fairly bad possibilities for a long time. I think maybe we're finally ready to get it right.
Layla Connors Peterson and Nadja Connors are our guests, co-directors and co-writers of The 11th Hour. Juan?
Layla Connors Peterson, I'd like to ask you about the Woolsey participation, an unusual role for him. And how did you learn of his concern about this issue and get him involved in the film?
Well, basically, we were aware of his position on energy. And what we were trying to do with his inclusion is to bridge the environmental idea into places, conservative circles perhaps, people who will only listen to Republicans or people who will not listen or call the environment a liberal issue. You know, really, the environmental issue is a human issue. It's a uniting issue. It shouldn't be divisive. Again, you know, the Earth is our only home. We all need to protect it. Now, Woolsey comes at this issue from a security standpoint, meaning, you know, why is this country depending on foreign oil? We should not depend on it. We should de-link and have access to, you know, have other sources of fuel, renewable energy. He's looking into switchgrass, biofuel from switchgrass. So that's the angle that he's coming into our film with, you know. And it just so happens that it's in concert and it works well with the same prescription for climate change, which is get off oil. I think we can all agree at this point, no matter where you fall on the spectrum, that fossil fuels and a civilization based on fossil fuels is not a healthy civilization. We need to move away from those fossil fuels and into renewables and find other sources of energy. And that's our biggest challenge. We need to find the energy source that will fuel the next 1,000 years, you know, several thousand years of human civilization. And it can't be fossil fuels. It causes climate change. It causes a lot of inequity in the world. What's so interesting about renewable energy, it's decentralized. You know, solar panels on the roof of a house is very empowering, whether you're in, you know, Westside, Los Angeles, New York City, or in Costa Rica, you know, off the grid. So we need to really look at how we fuel energy, fuel our civilization. Woolsey was coming in, you know, from a security standpoint.
I wanted to turn to another clip from the 11th Hour. Wes Jackson, the sustainable agriculture leader, the founder, and I remember going out to visiting him in the Land Institute in Kansas.
First of all, acknowledge that the planet is seamless. For instance, the fertilizer and the pesticides that are applied in the fields of the upper Midwest go down the Mississippi, and 1,100 miles away, there's a dead zone.
Nadja Connors, as we wrap up, what are you hoping will happen? The film opens tomorrow, the 11th hour around the country. What are your plans in getting it out?
Well, actually, the film opens tomorrow in New York and Los Angeles, and we are running a simultaneous campaign, an action campaign called 11thhouraction.com. And what we are trying to do is engage people before they see the movie and after they see the movie, because there is a lot of inspiration in this film. I mean, it is a dark time. It is a challenging time. And once you understand the scope of the problem, we've also provided an enormous amount of solutions. But
Nadja Connors, we're going to have to leave it there. Nadja Connors and Layla Connors Peterson, thanks so much for being with us, co-director and writers of The 11th Hour. And that does it for our broadcast. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Shufa Dokadus, Elizabeth Press, Ara Matea, Anjali Kamat, Jeffrey Hagerman, Steve Martinez, Nicole Salazar, Kyra Mache. I'm Amy Goodman, Juan Gonzalez. Our website, democracynow.org. Thanks so much for joining us.